session number 11191, Reel 2.
Reel 2.
The group of Hitlerjugend, of about 15 or 20 of them, formed a rough circle, and I landed in it, in this ploughed field, without any harm to myself. And I stood up and began to think that, after all, it wasn't so bad. It was a beautiful day, and these delightful young men were polite to me and made no attempt to molest me, folded my parachute, and firmly refused to allow me to move from that spot. And we stood looking at each other, not knowing who was going to do something next. After a few minutes, the gate of the flowered field opened, and in came an elderly gentleman. You must remember that I was 30 at that time, and this elderly gentleman, dressed up as a policeman, was about 55. He was pushing a bicycle, and he came up to me and pushed his revolver into my ribs rather forcibly. And he was terrified. He was pale. He was white with fear. He was far more frightened than I was. I was so relieved to be alive. And he didn't know what I was going to do. But he very brutally pushed this revolver into my ribs and shouted something at me in German, which I didn't understand then. And one of the boys said in perfect English, "He means hands up." So, of course, I put my hands up, and he looked very much relieved, searched me thoroughly to see if I had any weapons, and relaxed. And I gave him a cigarette. I was a smoker at the time. And we became rather more friendly. He said, apparently interpreted by this Hitler youth, who said in English, "He wants you to stay where you are until some army people come." And eventually, about 20 minutes later, they did. And they took me away, three German officers in a small car, as we were walking through the gate of the ploughed field. There were a group of farm laborers, workmen, who had collected at the gate, and one of them threw a bicycle at me as I walked through. Well, that was mild compared with the treatment that my navigator suffered, who landed in the middle of Mönchengladbach on a roof. And the crowd in the garden of the house in which he landed, they were having a tea party. And there he was on the roof. Somebody shinned up a ladder, got him down, and three or four of them took him to a lamppost in the street with a rope round his neck, and they were just tightening the rope when the Germans came up, the soldiers came up in motorbike and sidecar and kept the crowd away from them. The Germans were very unfriendly, you could imagine, after 1,000 raid on Cologne and all the misery that they're suffering. The Luftgangster was a term applied to us, and I can understand well how they regarded us. Anyway. The army people took me to the house of a Gauleiter, where I was interviewed by an intelligence officer that night, who wanted to know what this funny aircraft was that we were flying. Was it a jet? It was the fastest they'd ever experienced, and couldn't understand, because it was made of wood. The aircraft which I had lost was burned itself out, of course, and they discovered that it was made of wood, and couldn't understand. It was a complete mystery to them. So would I help them? And of course, we were all under instructions not to reveal anything but rank, name, and number. And they respected that. Then he, this intelligence officer and another officer, took me away, and were very, very polite and correct with me, and took me to a fighter, took me back to Mönchengladbach, near Mönchengladbach, where there was a fighter, a Luftwaffe fighter station. And I was put in one of the cells in the fighter station. And next door was my navigator in the next cell. So we met up, or didn't meet up, we spoke to each other through the bars. And we were kept there for a couple of days, and our treatment was reasonable, and the Luftwaffe people were very polite and interested in us. I remember the adjutant of the place said to me, "Why are you fighting? Because you're obviously fair-haired and blue-eyed." I had hair then. "Why are you fighting us? We should be on the same side." I said, "We don't like Nazis." So after 2 days, I think, we were both taken to a place called Dulag Luft, which is near Frankfurt on Main. And this is a transit camp which the Wehrmacht used for the interrogation of captured RAF prisoners before they're sent to the main camp. And we were there about 3 or 4 weeks. I was kept in a cell, a room rather. It wasn't as brutal as a cell. But it was a hot time of the year, and the electric fire was kept on all day. And part of the treatment, I think, because every day an intelligence officer would come and ask questions again, and continual interrogation. But there was no brutality, and it was limited to correct military procedure. There was one man, Major Binder, who spoke perfect English, and he had been employed at the AJS works in Birmingham, the people who made the motorcycles, before the war, and had become a technical officer in the Luftwaffe. And he reminisced about his British experiences during his youth and so on. And he said, "Will you give me your parole if we go a walk in the woods?" And that meant that I had to promise that I wouldn't escape. You know that. So I did, of course, and we had a very pleasant walk in the woods one day, where he gave me a splendid lunch, and hoped to still find out what kind of aircraft I was flying. Eventually, he gave up after 3 or 4 days of continual questioning, and I didn't see him again. Then, after all that, Richard and I were taken with several others, including Group Captain Massey and several other officers, to the main camp at Stalag Luft 3. And this was at a place called Sagan, S-A-G-A-N, which is now in Poland, of course. And we stayed there. I think I arrived in somewhere around the middle of June or something like that. And then began our real experience of what prisoner of war life was like. It was not very good. It was difficult to adjust for several months because of the very limited German rations and the proximity of other people. We were thrown willy-nilly into a room with other officers, can three-tier bunks, 10 men to a room, and not a very big room. And this is how we passed our days and nights. At that time, 1942, Red Cross parcels were not coming through very well. So and the German rations were hardly good enough to support an ordinary life. So we became, for the first 3 or 4 months, adjustment to prison camp was difficult for everybody. From having left the comparative civilized and sometimes luxurious life of RAF officers' mess into a prison camp was something of a shock.
You were saying about the poor rations.
Yes.
What would a typical day's food have been? Can you remember?
Yes, very well. There was one issue of soup a day, which was one about a cupful of soup. The soup was indifferent. It was usually cabbage water or something like that. It was hot, warm, but there was hardly. And sometimes on good days there was some meat in it, but very, very seldom. We had about a third of a, or less, of a slice of a typical small brown bread loaf. The bread was excellent, but the quantity of it was tiny per man. And we had to be very careful in rationing it out. And there was a small amount of so-called of margarine. Occasionally there was an issue of some kind of moldy cheese, which wasn't used by civilians, I suppose, and we were very glad to have that. When there was an issue of Red Cross parcels, life became more tolerable. But then we only had about half a parcel per man per fortnight of these precious things that came in the Red Cross parcels. The Red Cross are the most wonderful people in the world.
You were saying that you smoked.
Oh, yes. I didn't smoke at all until I was in the RAF, until I became a POW, in fact. And, of course, we had lots and lots of cigarettes. And, unfortunately, I began to smoke. And lots of us did.
Did your health stand up?
Fine,
sort of
fine, fine, fine. It was okay. I think probably we overeat in normal life. But it was okay. And we were all 20 to 30, 35 years old. So we were all pretty strong and fit. And it was okay. And that was a summer that we first arrived. After a time, after the first discomfort and trying time, we began to sort out our friends. Like-minded people began to gravitate to each other. And we formed little groups and eventually were able to set ourselves up in our own rooms, such as they were. We lived in wooden huts. You know what kind of place it must have been. And each hut was divided into small rooms where 10 men were housed in three-tier bunks. The most important thing was to find people that one had some kind of empathy with and live with them. It was possible to lead a tolerable life by having 7 or 8 such people, even if 3 or 4 were disagreeable. But anyway, I was fortunate in finding a group. And we stayed together all through the war, all through the Kriegsgefangenschaft. And it was one of the most interesting periods of my life.
How about clothing? Were you issued with any extra clothing to what you had landed in?
Yes, there was sometimes there were big parcels sent out by through the Swiss Red Cross of army surplus, not German army surplus, our army surplus, and we were able to clothe ourselves in things like that. We, in the cold winters, we were given, supplied by the Dutch apparently, Dutch sabots, clogs, which were marvellous to keep the feet warm in the very cold weather. Wonderful. I've got a photograph of some of us standing there in wooden boots, wooden clogs. But our clothing was looked after fairly reasonably. We were able to wash primitively in wash places with cold taps, no hot water, of course. But we were able to maintain a fairly reasonable standard of cleanliness. The abortes, the lavatories, the abortes were 40-seaters or 50-seaters and very primitive, but sufficed.
And how about the administration of the camp? You know, did you have a hierarchy?
Yes, we did. We had a senior British officer, of course. At the time that I arrived, it was the famous Wings Day, Wing Commander Day, who had been, at the time I arrived, he'd been there 2 years or three, from the beginning almost. But he was a good senior British officer. And in the camp were about, as I remember it, 8 of these large huts in our compound. One of them was called the flagship. And in the flagship was a senior British officer and the escape committee and people like that. So if you had an idea to escape, you had to discuss it with the escape committee, Big X, as we call the boss of that, and no one was allowed to escape unless the scheme was approved by him.
This camp administration, what were its relations with the Germans? Was there communication?
Yes, oh yes, every day we had roll call, of course sometimes 6 days a week, 6 times a day, and sometimes twice in the middle of the night, particularly during the troubled times when people were trying hard to get out. Yes, we had to appear on roll call. On good days, perhaps 4 times a day, but on bad times, perhaps 6 times a day. And then we formed in a half square with the senior British officer in the middle of the square, and the German officers came out and counted us. The Feldwebels counted us. And then, if all were present, except those who were crank in Zimmer, sick in room, we fell out. I remember at this time that Bader had a small following of eager fighter pilots who caused quite a lot of disturbance occasionally. They thought that by disrupting the roll call, they were annoying the Germans. They did, but it only made life a little more difficult for everybody, because the Germans had the whip hand and yes, could keep us standing there as long as they liked. So some of us didn't approve of Bader's naughtiness. Although I remember it was very impressive when Bader was eventually removed to Colditz, and he had no leg, as you know. He stumbled about, and they formed up a guard for him. He was, I'm not sure if he was wing commander or group captain, but he was a senior officer and a person of some fame at this time. And on the day that he was moved to Colditz, he was taken out of the camp by the Oberst, the German commander, and taken out to the group of German soldiers Luftwaffe soldiers who were to take him away to the train. And he reviewed them. It was very funny to see him walk down slowly at his pace right down the front of these very C3 German Luftwaffe soldiers at the back, and as if he were the king. It was very interesting and very amusing. At those apart. In September 1942, about several hundred of us were taken from Stalag Luft 3, put into cattle trucks, and moved to a place in deep in Poland, not very far from Bromberg, I think it was, called Shubin, S-C-H-U-B-I-N. And this was a prison camp which was, I think it had been used at one time as a girls' school, but brick huts had been built in it, and it had been turned into a prison camp which held French soldiers. They had been cleared out, and we were poured into it. And that was a bad time, because at Shubin, we were looked after or kept in by the Wehrmacht, who were army. And they were less friendly and less understanding, rather more tough than the Luftwaffe guards who we had at Stalag Luft 3. We had a successful break out of Shubin, which was built from the abort. I was engaged on this tunnel, and we had great hopes of it. It was a very uncomfortable entrance and exit, but the tunnel itself was very successful. Eventually, I think we got about 15 out of this tunnel, including Anthony Barber, and all of them were re-caught. Barber and two or three others were at liberty for a week or two. He was trapped at a railway station early one morning at five o'clock in the morning. He'd been hiding all night in the lavatory, but the police found him and brought him back, and all the others came back. It was very difficult. I never successfully escaped. I was in several tunnels, but never actually broke surface. Those who did were all brought. Of course, I'm jumping the gun a bit. Let me finish with Shubin. Shubin was a tough place, and our rations were very limited. The army were very difficult. And I remember one man who was not really all there. He should have been in a hospital. We called him Edwards, Pissy Edwards, poor old Pissy Edwards. Began to climb the wire, and he was shot on the wire, dead. And this caused us great distress, because the man should have been put in a hospital. He wasn't fit. He suddenly stood up and began to climb the wire, which was a big mistake. We also had another tunnel going from that camp. The Wehrmacht were not so intelligent as the Luftwaffe, who were very clever at spotting tunnels. The Wehrmacht were not so good. We had another very good tunnel, which unfortunately didn't succeed in getting anybody out. But it was a great feat of engineering, organized by a man called Edwards, who was a bank clerk before the war, and turned into a first-class tunneler. He made a wonderful entrance to the tunnel again from the abort, which was a very unpleasant place to begin work. But he dug a shaft about 12 feet down, and then a huge chamber, all taking weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And we had a long ventilation system made out of milk tins, so that oxygen was pumped at the face while we dug away at it. And we all took shift turns in getting tunneling. And the earth was very sound. At Stalag Luft 3, the earth was a bit unreliable because it was sand, but in Tubin it was hard clay. And although we supported it with bed boards, boards that were taken off our beds and improvised into into supports in the tunnel, a lot of it was very sound. So we went quite a long way and beyond the wire. And it was a sad day when, unfortunately, Squadron Leader Strong was on watch to make sure that while the people who were taking out the sand and the clay were able to disperse it on a bank by the side of the hut. And it was very important that they weren't observed by the Germans. The guard constantly walked up and down, and Strong had to give... I'm not sure that I like repeating it because Dim Strong is not very happy, but he's an air commodore now. And he's a very sound chap. But anyway, the German guard saw our boys busily spreading this earth on the bank, and at once blew his whistle and all hell let loose. And they in came the Wehrmacht, in came the troops. Out, everything was thrown out, all the bedding, every possession we had was thrown out, and they stripped the place, and eventually it took them half a day to find the entrance, and they thought we were disgusting to do it from such a place. Anyway, the thing was discovered, and some Russian prisoners were brought in to dig it up, and they did. They brought about 20 Russian prisoners in outside the wire who dug a trench across the tunnel until eventually they found it. But I remember this was a very exciting moment because the door of the block was screwed up. They put wooden planks against the door so that nobody could go in until they'd finished. One of our German speakers engaged the postman, the guard, by this door and began to talk about him to him in a very interesting way, secured his attention for long enough for two men, Pop Pullen and Plunkett, to unscrew the planks, open the door and get down the shaft, screw up the planks again while the German was being talked to, and down they went. And we prayed for them. And we watched the Russians digging the trench outside the wire, and suddenly one of them stood up in horror because they'd gone through the tunnel from one side of the trench to the other and stayed all night there, Pop Pullen and Plunkett, until the middle of the night when they broke surface. And then, sadly, we heard the shots beginning to fire. They weren't killed. They were brought back in. So that was Shubin.
Important was it, you know, to have escape plans?
It was for the first year. It becomes it's an obsession, and see, with some it stays an obsession, which I think is a pity because, well, for me it became less of an obsession after I realised the tremendous odds against success anyway. But of course, I was tempted occasionally in the second year to dig with tunnels, but I became less enthusiastic. By this time, one is becoming psychologically adjusted to the life